Bloomberg Surveillance with Ken Pruitt and Tom Keene. If you're listening via our new Radio Plus iPhone app, did you know you can get detailed information about a stock by simply touching its symbol on the crawling stock ticker? If you don't have the Radio Plus iPhone app yet, you'll want to download it. It's free via the iTunes App Store.
William Dunkelberg. Bill, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
You're fired up about the minimum wage. Ken will run through that here in a minute in Business Week. But let me just ask you a question to get the blood going. If I adjust for inflation, isn't the minimum wage lower than it's been in years?
Well, that could be if you adjust it for inflation. In real terms, it probably is lower. But the real question is, why should we have a minimum wage? What we're doing is keeping lots of young people from ever getting their first job. And, I'd much rather see a program that said, negotiate a job with anybody that you can, get a job, get work experience, don't just stand around on the street corner. And then if the government thinks that you're not earning enough based on the 15 children that you have or whatever criteria they have, we have the earned income tax credit that we can send money back your way. But the way it is now, you raise this minimum wage, it's harder to get a job. You'd never get the first job.
Well, Bill, aren't the studies by economists sort of inconclusive? I mean, some say it costs jobs and some say it doesn't.
I think most of the studies, and we've been, of course, looking at this for decades, say that it costs jobs. The general story you get is, we admit that it costs something on the unemployment side, but we still think on balance it's a benefit. That's the story you get from, say 40% of the economists. I think most labor economists who really study labor markets, of course, are pretty convinced it's bad. And then you have some economists like Walter Williams at George Mason who think it's one of the worst things that we ever could have done to minorities is to have the minimum wage, especially in cities.
Where would the minimum wage, where would the wage be if there was no minimum wage? Do we have any study of how far back we go to, say, pre-1940? Or to the 19th century if we bring the wage down?
Well, that's a good question, but that's such a different world, I guess. It would be hard to make a comparison. Look, firms cannot pay people more than the value they bring to the firm. So everybody who's working now, obviously, is working is worth what they're bringing to the firm, or the firm would have fired them, as we did, of course, during the Great Recession, when consumer spending slowed down dramatically, then a lot of people couldn't bring that value to the firm, and we had to let them go. So everybody who's there is there, and there's no reason why they would be particularly impacted by the elimination of the minimum wage. They're doing fine. What eliminating it would do would allow us to hire different individuals, including those who maybe are impaired in some way, for lower wages, and then they get a job.
Is the debate, Bill Dunkelberg, about the minimum wage the same now as it was, say, in 1955?
Oh, I think probably. That's hard for me to go back quite that far, but I've been worrying about it, since the 1960s. And so, a lot of academic work has been done on that, and there's a lot of confusion about, what the minimum wage does. You still see the case made that, that it really increases income and spending, as if this money that minimum wage workers would get comes out of nowhere. But if you look at where most of the minimum wage workers are, they're in the services sector, and you could think of a pizza parlor or whatever. So if you raise the wage cost by 10% for a bunch of workers, that cost has to go somewhere. So it either goes out of the pockets of the entrepreneur, and of course this is a very competitive little business area, so I'm not sure there's a lot of excess profits there, but it comes out of the profit, or it comes out of higher prices, so it comes out of customers' pockets. So there's no extra money in the market. There's no extra spending. Every dollar the minimum wage worker gets comes out of somebody's pocket. So the notion that this is somehow a stimulus is really nonsense.
Bill, how are your constituents, so to speak, the small business operators, how are they dealing with health care reform? Are they just kind of on hold waiting to see what the Supreme Court says?
So I think basically that's the deal. We're going to wait and see what things we have to comply with and what things we don't have to comply with. So, as you know, NFIB is one of the participants in the suit. So we're up there at the Supreme Court, where we were up there listening to the arguments, and now we're waiting to see what happens. we try to prepare our people for, you know, try to give them some guidance, but so much of the regulation is really not written yet, so it's hard to tell people what exactly is going to happen and what they're going to have to do.
What are you hearing about the timing of an announcement from the court?
Last I heard was it'd probably be sometime in June, so we're just kind of sitting tight now and waiting on that.
Bill, as a frontline economist, let's talk to you about first quarter GDP as well. We talked to Harm Bondels about the dynamics of trade. Tell us about how you, as a pro, analyze and measure inventories. How do they fold into what we see here at 8:30?
Well, inventory, of course, is one of the things that we're one of the places we can put our production as we make stuff, and that which we don't sell goes into inventory, so that's why it's part of investment, if you will, in the GDP numbers. So, you know, whatever we don't sell to somebody will show up as an increase in inventories. And my guess is we'll probably see some inventory build still in the GDP numbers. We'll also see, you know, probably maybe a little bit better than we expect number for consumer spending, simply because auto purchases have been picking up, and of course it's not like a hamburger. You know, we don't put a lot of our current income into the purchase of the car. We make a 5-year commitment to make payments, so we'll get a big spending number, the total price of the car, but we don't need to finance that out of current income, just the down payment, so to speak. So, you know, so I'm looking for a GDP number that's not much better than 2, but over 2.
But over 2. Our survey says 2.5. That's a survey consensus of economists in our survey. What about the rest of the year, Bill?
The rest of the year, you know, I think there's just still a huge amount of uncertainty out there for business owners. So what we see in our survey, in the March survey, of course, was that optimism actually fell. There were no plans really to hire, create new jobs. So we're still kind of on hold. There's got to be some good reason for these people to bet their money on the future, that is to invest in expanding the business or hire a worker if customers haven't shown up yet. So I think they're not very confident. They need to see some resolution in the whole tax issue and the health care issue. And of course, we're still concerned about what's going to happen in financial markets. What will happen in Europe? They worry about that, even if it doesn't have an immediate direct impact on their real business levels. It's a concern.
Bill, let's talk about the people coming in the door of a small business and just the general idea of an output gap. Harm Bondels with us earlier, talking up the Taylor Rule and some of the mysteries of how the Fed, given this economy, tries to measure where we are or where we're going. Small business has to deal with the output gap, I would suggest, in a much different way than big business. How big is the output gap?
Oh, heavens. You know, that's one of those wonderful things we write lots of articles about. What we do know is that we're making is more GDP than we did at the peak in 2007, and we're using 7 million fewer workers to do it. So what is the output gap? Well, one could argue that, you know, it really isn't very big because we're making now the GDP we were at the peak in 2007. But you still have 8 million unemployed workers, so the question is, can you somehow put them to work doing something, and that whatever they do, can they sell that to somebody? I think that's really the issue that we're looking at here, and so it makes computing a meaningful gap, kind of a complicated number. If you just drive it by unemployment, you'd say, well, the output gap is huge because 7 or 8 million people could produce just an awful lot of output that we aren't producing, so the gap is huge. You could argue that, you know, factories are running, the manufacturing sector is really going full, et cetera, et cetera. GDP is bigger than it was in the last peak, so the gap is not that large. And we argue all over the space on that.
We do. Thank you. Bill Dunkelberg, thank you so much.
Listen to Bloomberg Surveillance weekday mornings at 7 Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2012.